Hey there, Sports History fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
Before they were the monsters of the Midway, the Chicago Bears had their start in a different Illinois town and somewhat took a much different evolution from most of the other original APFA teams. Joe Ziemba, the great author and podcast host of When Football Was Football, visits the Pigpen once again to guide us through the history of the Decatur's Dailies.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com, and welcome once again to the Pigpen. Another day of getting to talk about some early professional football teams. And we have our friend Joe Ziemba of When Football Was Football podcast and author of multiple books. Joe Ziemba, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Oh, Darren, it's always a pleasure to be here. And you are, I'm not saying becoming, you are now the source of pro football history, and a whole bunch of people will enjoy that, including myself. So thank you again for allowing me to participate.
Well, I thank you, because it's folks like you and our other guests that we have on here that really bring the history to life. I'm just a facilitator and moderator of bringing it together. So I appreciate all of you coming on and sharing your passion and your knowledge. And you definitely have a ton of it, and we're glad to be able to tap into that once again tonight.
So thank you very much. Yeah, you've selected a great topic and can't wait to jump in on it.
Well, I guess before we get to it, because it's sort of on topic, you just told me the other day in an email that that book you've been writing on Chicago football, is now you've got a title for it and you've got sort of a plan of a release date. Maybe if I know you've talked about it on your podcast, but maybe if you could share that with our listeners, what the title is and what's going on with the book.
Oh, great. Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, this is one of the earliest announcements, but the book that we've been working on for a long, long time is called Bears versus Cardinals, the NFL's Oldest Rivalry, and it'll be published by McFarlane in the spring of next year, 2022. And what we've done is take a really deep look at the early history of both the Bears and the Cardinals when they were both in Chicago. So we're going to start in 1899 when the Cardinals were founded, and the story will continue through 1960, and that's when the Cardinals left Chicago with more than a slight nudge from George Halas of the Bears. And a lot of that might be due to the burgeoning TV exposure the NFL was getting and the blackout situation. But it was a bitter rivalry when the two of them met two or sometimes three times a year in Chicago for almost 40 years. So I'm hoping your listeners will enjoy reading that or give it a shot, and looking forward to seeing finally come to fruition after a whole bunch of research over the years.
Well, that's got to be exciting for you and everybody that's helped you. I know me hearing, being on the outskirts and hearing, talking to you, usually once a week we did for, but basically most of this year, just hearing little tidbits of what you were doing. I know I'm excited, and the people you were working with and what your research hours, it's going to be good. I know it. Now, I guess we're going to be talking a little bit about one side of that book tonight. And we're going to be talking about the history of the Decatur Staleys, one of the original APFA NFL teams. And I'm excited to hear all about that. So I'll let you lead us into where you want to start on that story.
Oh, sure. And it is a great story. The Decatur Staleys, who are now the Chicago Bears. And many people think that when George Halas was hired by the A.E. Staley Company in 1920, that was the first year of sports for the Staley Company. But actually, the football team started in 1919. But even before then, there was a baseball team that achieved some notoriety that began in 1917, I believe. And I'm always grateful when you can find research resources to take a peek behind the curtain at some of these old teams. And for some of the research for tonight and a lot that I used in my book, we have the Staley Fellowship Club Journal, which was published on a monthly basis by the A.E. Staley Company. It was started out as an 8-page flyer and eventually became a 40-page magazine, perhaps even longer. And it talked about everything from safety in the plant, because the Staley Company was a starch manufacturer in Decatur, Illinois, hence the Decatur Staleys. In fact, one time they tried to get a nickname for the baseball team, had a contest among the employees, and the name Squirrels came up, but the management didn't really like that as one of the contenders. So they just stuck to the Staleys for the time being. But
now, Joe, do you know how big was the Staley starch company? How big of a place was it? How many employees would they have had?
Oh, good question. That I do not know. I know that it had, even back then, sales in the millions, because that was another thing that I wanted to look into at the time, and was the biggest employer in Decatur, which was a good sized city even back then, 100 years ago. So they had their own facilities, their own fields, their own manufacturing plants, of course, different sections. In fact, the first baseball team drew its participants from all parts of the plant, and would mention in the fellowship journal, we'll call it the journal, how the team did and where the different players were from the plant. For example, in one of the early games in 1917, the team played the Cheap Charlies from Bloomington, Illinois, and they defeated us by the score of 5-0, said the journal. We had no support. Our battery column was feeling bad, and it seemed like our boys were listless. So it was pretty harsh criticism for an intramural team, basically. All the players came from within the plant, and that was their traveling team. They also had intramural squads, and so you had representative teams from the carpenters, the electricians, the lump starch section, and this is the name of the team, called the Nut Blasters. So sometimes you can't make these things up, but the journal told us all about that. So there were some complaints back then in 1917, and the journal covered their participation of the team in the commercial league, and they were able to land the flag. They won the pennant that first year, and one of their big rivals was the Mueller Company, and they beat them 2-1. So the boys, they said, were now playing with their sights set on the flag in the future, and they enjoyed that successful season in 1917. And then in 1918, they started thinking, maybe some of these other teams are bringing in ringers. And this is where I started to see the similarity between the football team and the baseball team and how they started. For example, the journal stated in a game against the Wabash Car Shops, won the pennant. And the Staleys had the material, they said, but something the opposition was encountered were players that would show up who didn't seem to know what team they're actually playing for. And they thought these other industrial teams maybe were bringing in ringers. And the journal also complained, and here's a good quote. It said, when someone complained about our players, they said, we meekly allowed these men to be barred from playing while some of the other teams play not their own employees, but rake the city to reinforce their teams. It's hoped that if our team is entered in the league next season, matters will be handled in a more businesslike manner. So they were afraid of other teams getting professionals, but the Staleys couldn't use their professionals, so to speak, or if someone questioned it, they would not let the players play. But in 1919 then, again, this is before George Hellas came aboard in the spring of 1920, the Staleys had somewhat improved their roster and even scheduled a game with the Chicago White Sox. They were competitive, losing just 8-1 in a game played in May of that year. Everybody had a great time, but the journal described what it was like to have the Major League Baseball team come to Decatur instead of the other way around, which we would think would be what would happen in a game between two such opponents. And it said the special train from Chicago bringing the White Sox to the game was switched into the yard on time. So that's news in Decatur. The photographer was on hand to get a picture of both teams, and even the movie man was turning his machine on them, and 3,000 fans showed up to watch the White Sox beat the Staleys 8-1. So I'm thinking about that time. They're getting large crowds. They're attracting a major league team and somewhat competitive. But then in July of that year, the guy who was a foreman in the company that was the manager, Jack Fletcher, gave way to Joe McGinty, Iron Joe, who had a Major League Baseball player who appeared on the roster of the Staleys. And the reason they gave for Jack Fletcher departing was that he was managing a lot of the construction work. And then he had to answer telegrams, make phone calls, make schedules. And he was one of the more important foremen in the plant. He just didn't have time. So to me, that's saying that, whoa, all of a sudden they're going from a local guy running the team to bringing in a former major league player. And around that time, I think, is when the football team started. That would have been October. I think September 24th was the first practice. And they had a coach from the University of Illinois, which was a construction superintendent at the plant, named James Cook. He had those guys out there practicing every night at 5 o'clock on the Staley Field, as we mentioned. And according to all indications, the journal said, they're going to turn out to be one of the finest bunch of semi-pro football players that in the world. So that's pretty high praise in 1919. So the football team scheduled local competition. They opened up with a loss, however, to the Peoria Tractors. That gave them the one loss, but then after a cancellation against those dastardly Rantoul Aviators, they won their final six games in a row to finish with a 6-1 record. They knocked off the Taylorville Independents, which was a big upset, the Champaign 11, and then wrapped up the season with a 41-0 win over the Arcola Independents in 1919. So they finished 6-1, and there was a lot of emphasis placed on the team. They were getting good coverage from the local Decatur newspapers. There were some rumors that the players were receiving $10 or $20 a game in addition to their salaries that they received working at the Staley plant. But that was figured to be a little bit lower than what some of their opponents were getting. So we're still seeing this nudge or this really strong hint that everybody else was professional except the Staleys. And the Decatur Daily Review said some of those games, those players were receiving a lot of money, although they didn't pinpoint it exactly. So for the 1919 team, the players all seemed to be from the plant. They played at Illinois colleges. It might have been the University of Illinois, Milliken, places like that. And then in the spring of 1920, actually winter is when George Halas got the call that the Staleys were looking to start a football team and looking for someone to run it for them. So he would have to decide what to do about the team. He pretty much cleaned house. By the end of the season, the Staleys had also another coach called Red Brannon. We don't hear from him again. And the big thing about the 1919 team was their upset win over the Taylorville teams. And Taylorville has come up before in one of the big scandals that occurred a couple of years later when Taylorville and their opponents used players from Illinois and from Notre Dame, and they got caught. And big scandal, even a little bit led to Green Bay getting kicked out of the NFL for a few months in 1921. So we brought it up to date as to where George Halas has joined the team in 1920. And even before he played his first baseball game, there was an article that mentioned him in the Fellowship Journal. And it was talking about Halas played earlier the year before with the New York Yankees. And now he was going to be working for the Staleys. He said he played sensational baseball with Illinois and the Great Lakes Naval Training Station before he was signed and given a trial by the New York Yankees, where, as we know, he couldn't hit the curveball. And it said, George, who was a wonderful football and basketball man, will be a big addition to the Staley team. So although they didn't have a they did have a basketball team, but apparently George Halas did not play basketball for the Staleys. He definitely played baseball, definitely ran the football team. So it was in 1920 that Halas was hired, and he was asked for and given the guarantee that the players would have jobs, but they could also take off a little early in practice every day, which was a huge advantage. The schedule had not been put together early that year, of course, but Halas was part of the early founders, or one of the founders of what we now know as the NFL, as he traveled to Canton to become part of that original meeting there in the late summer of 1920. But what he did that summer was unprecedented in terms of the professionals as we know them. And there was really no professional league when he started this. But Halas moved around the country, and at least on the Eastern and Midwest part, recruiting players, looking for some of his old teammates. He had Dutch Sterneman from Illinois, Jimmy Councilman from St. Louis was on the team. And they had a pretty good season as part of the American Professional Football Association, finishing in second place. Halas brought together a bunch of players, had them practice, had them working there. I believe he, as I mentioned, pretty much cleaned up the roster. So they went kind of like the baseball team, and here's that correlation to having a professional manage the team as the baseball did, as well as recruiting players who were players, not really starch workers. So up to that point, 1920, then we had the Staleys, who quickly under George Halas became a very dominant part of what would be known as the National Football League. They played a couple of the local teams as they had before. Could tell Halas was probably trying to find out where his talent level was. Although when you bring in guys from Nebraska and Michigan and Illinois to play for your team against the Moline Universal Tractors and the Kewaunee Wowers, you're probably going to have some success. And so they did have a great deal of success, winning their first five games easily. They had a tie with the Rock Island Independents. This is quite a famous game, I believe. This is where the Rock Island fans were so incensed at the playing of George Trafton of the Staleys that they literally started attacking the team as they left the field. And Halas had given Trafton the money and told him to run for his life, basically, and don't worry about the money so much. So that was one of those interesting stories we mentioned in the book as well about the early days of pro football and how wild it was. So after that tie game, they won four more, beating teams like the Champaign Legion, the Minneapolis Marines, the Hammond Pros, who Halas had played for in 1919 himself, and the Chicago Tigers. They beat them 6-0. And what was interesting, when they played the Tigers the first time on October 24th, Halas moved from the Staley Field, which probably sat about 1,500 people. You could have standing room as well. Ticket prices were $1. If you're an employee, you got 50% off. So there wasn't much revenue coming back into the A.E. Staley Company. But Halas got the idea to go to Cubs Park. This is before it was named Wrigley Field. And in his game with the Tigers on October 24th, they drew 5,000 people, which is a lot better than the 1,500 that they drew at the Staley Field. And then they returned to Cubs Park for a rematch with the Tigers on November 25th and drew 8,000 people. But nothing really could surpass this new rivalry. They started with a team called the Cardinals. And that first game took place on November 28th at Normal Park in Chicago. It's where the Cardinals played their games. That held a few more people than the Staley Field, with about 7,000, 8,000 with standing room. And in the game, the first game, November 28th of 1920, the Cardinals won 7-6, which was the first defeat for the Staleys of the season. And it would turn out to be the only defeat. There was controversy at the end, because the crowd literally was right up to the edge of the field. They had ropes to hold them back, but that didn't do too much. And one of the players on the Cardinals was running along the sideline and kind of disappeared into the crowd. And George Halas claimed later and claimed to the officials that the fans interfered with his players going to make the tackle. And the Cardinals, with that touchdown and the extra point by Patty Driscoll, won 7-6. But Halas was so upset by it, he was still talking about it 20 years later, how unfair it was. And Red Smith, the great columnist, wrote something like, Halas implored the referees to make a change in their decision, but looking at the overpowering crowd behind the Cardinals, referees decided they'd rather not be dead than change the decision or make any decision on that. The teams had such a great time, they decided to play again the next week, moving back to Cubs Park. This time, 11,000 people showed up. Biggest crowd ever to see pro football in Chicago, and the Staleys won 10-0 to kind of ambush the Cardinals and get revenge for that defeat. The Staleys thought they had a real good shot at catching the Akron Pros for the championship of the league that first year. But in a final game, which might be called a playoff, they met in Chicago again at Cubs Park on December 12th, ended up in a 0-0 tie. And the Staleys' record of 10-1-2 was only good then for second place in the league. So that ended the 1920 season. Halas was all excited. He thought he had something special. People were coming to games. And he revised his roster accordingly for the 1921 season.
Joe, before we get into 21 season, I just got to have a couple questions. I just want to make sure something. Now, you said that Halas was hired by the Staley Company in the spring of 1920?
Right, yes.
So in that short amount of time, less than 6 months, I'm assuming, he was hired by the Staley Company, took over the football team, had enough power to go to Canton to meet both in the August 20th and the September 17th meeting of the APFA and I guess APFC and then APFA meeting.
Yep.
And start a new league and then take second place in that league. That's truly amazing. And he was a fairly young man at that time too, wasn't he?
He was, yeah. He had he would have graduated, I think, in 1918. So yeah, he's probably 23, 24 years old. Plus he played baseball and they had a pretty lengthy schedule. So in between of all that, the traveling for baseball, working in the plant, recruiting for football, it was truly amazing what he accomplished that year in 1920.
I don't know if I had that much gumption when I was 22, 23 years old to do all that. That's a lot.
Yeah. In fact, he was anxious when football finally started in September of 1920 that he could just concentrate on football. No more recruiting, no more baseball. He could focus on football as the coach and acting as the general manager as well.
So I take it that he probably didn't have a lot of duties in the plant with the Staley Company. He was probably, you know, pretty much focused on the football and baseball aspects. Would that be a fair statement?
Yeah, he had an engineering degree and I don't know exactly what he did in the plant, but in his autobiography, he doesn't really talk about much about what he did besides football either. a couple mentions here and there about work, but always proud that he got the assurance that they could take time out to practice during the workday.
Yeah, I'm almost picturing it almost like the college football coach. You know, he's part of the university, but he really doesn't probably teach too much academically. But
right, yes.
So it's probably a similar position with Halas and the Staley some company. Oh, very interesting. Okay, I'm sorry. Let's go into 1921.
Yeah, so 21, as we mentioned, the Staleys did win the what would become the NFL title that year with their 10-1-1 record. They start out the season playing a couple home games at the Staley Field. They beat the Waukegan Legion 35-0 and the Rock Island Independents 14-10. And then they played every game at home basically because the remaining schedule, the last 10 games were all at Cubs Park. And in that time, in mid-October or so, late October, is when Halas was called into A.E. Staley's office. And Staley wanted to know what was I'm trying to do this nicely. I have an opinion in my book, but I'm not going to share it right now. But what Halas said in his autobiography is that Mr. Staley came in and offered him seed money of $5,000, telling him that the football team, with its success and its notoriety, and had brought a lot of good publicity to the company, which is one of the intents of having a baseball and football team. But Mr. Staley indicated to Hallis that this needs a bigger city, and he suggested that they move the team to Chicago then for the remainder of the season. And Hallis talks about how he had to go right away up to Cubs Park and try and reserve it for the end of the season. So, but there's a lot of items that kind of clash in the stories. One was a partnership that he developed with Dutch Sterneman and Chick Harley and Bill Harley in July of 1921. He brought Chick Harley, probably the most famous football player around in college at Ohio State the year before, a couple of years before, to come in and play for the Staleys as well. So that was one thing that kind of odd, that he would have a partnership in the team when the Staleys really owned it. So they were talking about different players, and those first two games is when the decision was made. One thing that always caught my eye is there, Mr. Staley did not, there's no records left. I've checked with the Staley Museum and some historians in Decatur, and there's no records from Mr. Staley, any correspondence except the one letter that served as a contract for George Hallis to take the team to Chicago. And the one line that got me was at the end of this letter that, of course, indicated that Mr. Staley would provide the seed money for the team. He only wanted the team to be known as the Chicago Staleys until the end of the season. So he was paying for advertising in the program and continuing to pay the players, even though the players now were free to depart to go to Chicago. But the one line that kind of got me in that letter, and that letter has been published a lot, and it says, once you leave, we do not expect you to return, if I'm quoting that somewhat correctly. And I thought, it was kind of a little bit harsh. but later on, as I research more and you see things like the partnership with the Harley brothers, and the rental agreements with Cubs Park, everything fell into place pretty nice. But much of this comes from the autobiography of Hallis, which he wrote about 50 years later. He did write a series that was, the autobiography was based on in the late 60s and the 70s, his autobiography came out. So 50 years later, he's kind of recollecting some of this stuff. So there are a couple of contradictions is the word I'm looking for. But whatever it was, the Staleys did move to Chicago. They enjoyed some decent, not great attendance that year, 8,000, 10,000. They had 12,000 when the Buffalo All-Americans came. But even in their last game of the season, they had a tie with the Cardinals, 0-0 tie, only 2,000 people showed up. But Hallis was pretty convinced that pro football had a future. And so after the 1921 season, the Staley name sort of went away. There was other things that were taking place now. For example, the Staleys did win the title in 21. Buffalo still thinks they won it because of a late game between the two teams. That same Buffalo apparently thought it was for an exhibition. Hallis thought otherwise and convinced the other owners for that. Some people in Buffalo call it the Staley Swindle from 1921. But all in all, it does capture how pro football started in Decatur, Illinois, how George Hallis was one of the founders, and how that team moved to Chicago to become the Chicago Staleys, and now known as, of course, the Chicago Bears, one of two remaining franchises, along with the Cardinals, that are still in the National Football League.
Okay, so the team was technically the Decatur Staleys for what, one or two seasons?
Yeah, just 1921.
1920 in the APFA, but they were a semi-pro team before that as Decatur Staleys.
Right, 1919.
And then 1921, they were technically the Chicago Staleys.
Right, yeah, that's right, man.
Yep. And then they were the Chicago Bears 1922 on.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Just wanted to make that clear.
So. And then the owners' meetings after that 21 season is where there was a lot of controversy, because the owners had to decide who had the franchise. Would it be George Hallis and Dutch Sterneman, or to be the Harley brothers. Both applied because both all four thought they were the owners. And so that got a little messy as well, but Alice was awarded the franchise. Harley's ended up in a lawsuit, which took a couple of years to clear up. So it was those early years seemed like something always happened at the end of the year. I'm glad now they've kind of gotten it straightened out. Maybe not altogether, but 100 years to work on it there, Darren.
Well, I'm not so sure. I mean, you talked about the Buffalo All-Americans claiming to title. We talked with Ken Crippen recently on the All-Americans history, and you know he's a Buffalo native, and he said they've gone to the NFL as recent as a few years ago, I believe he said, trying to give the All-Stars the title for that 1921 season. So even 100 years later, there's still some bitterness over that some of the activities that did happen back then that Mr. Hallis was a part of. So he's still controversial.
Oh, he is. And almost every year, and early in 1922, when he was still fighting the lawsuit with Harley's, he offered Paddy Driscoll, the star of the Cardinals, a ownership in the Bears. Although Driscoll was under contract to the Cardinals at the time. And so at that owner's meeting, which Hallis did not attend, he had his hand slapped for that as well. So all sorts of things, all sorts of controversies in those early years of pro football. And I guess that's why we enjoy talking about it, not forgetting what some of those early pioneers went through to get the game on the field as we know it today. But always fun stuff talking when we go back.
Boy, we think that Mr. Schneider in Washington and Mr. Jones in Dallas are controversial owners. I think Hallis might have had them beat, a century earlier.
Yeah, Hallis always had his hand in something, and whether it was he picked up Paddy Driscoll to play for the Staleys in one of their, I think it was the end of the 1921 season, which was totally against what the professional league stood for, the roster jumping and the players, etc. So he continued and found some interesting things when you look back in the history and research it pretty thoroughly, and I hope we have done that for this new book. But even why one team decided not to play against the Bears because they specifically didn't like some of the financial maneuvering, they called it, by the management of the team.
Some things never change, right?
Yeah.
All right. So they're the champions in 1921. 1922, they are the Bears. How'd they do in the 22 season?
22, I think they did fairly well. I guess I should have known that, but I don't have that in front of me. I actually do have it in front of me because I have a draft of the book in front of me. But I think they continued to do well, but slipped a little bit. But 22 was the season where they had a great riot with the Chicago Cardinals. And I think the loss to the Cardinals hindered them a little bit. They didn't win the championship that year.
But so they were vying for the title the first 3 years of the NFL, so to speak, under APFA for the first two. But wow, that's quite a testament, though. So the guys, starts out right 6 months before the first season, helps organize the league and is competitive the first three seasons with his team and the players he's bringing in. So that's quite a testament to the team and to what Mr. Hallis did. And
I always found it kind of ironic that 1925, when they really weren't a contender, were not a contender, but that was the year that Red Grange joined the team. And so Hallis could care less. They were making money at that time. So he bounced back after that again.
I guess so, yeah. And when did Mr. Hallis pass away? Was it the 90s or the 80s when he?
I think it was 83.
83?
Yeah, because he was about 88. Yeah, I shouldn't say that because I don't know, but I thought it was the early 80s.
Yeah, I know it was in my lifetime. I remember him, them showing him in the booth, during a game or two. He wasn't, of course, coaching at that time or anything, but fascinating man for sure.
Yeah.
Quite a polarizing individual in the history of the NFL. Mm-hmm. So very interesting.
And what a nice, strong individual, though, that was able to push through those early days with no money and then hit the Depression and able to adjust and move forward, then the war, and still keep that franchise going. It is quite amazing.
Yeah, it definitely is. Well, we are definitely looking forward to hear more detail on this, or read more detail once your book comes out. Now, did you say you think it's coming out in sometime in 2022?
Yeah, it's supposed to be the second quarter, which will be the spring of 2022. And don't have an exact date, though. We'll let you know as soon as we do.
We know how things are going in the world as far as getting things to consumers. So I'm sure the book business is probably the same boat that everybody else is in. So
yes,
we'll hold with bated breath.
Yep.
Very excited to do that. So when you hear something, please let us know and we will pass it on to the listeners here, or even have you on again to break the news, because we appreciate doing that. And we're all very interested in reading your great book, another one that you have.
Oh, thank you. And as always, we appreciate what you're doing, and not only for myself, but for everyone else who is interested in the history of pro football. And thank you for all you do. And as I've told you personally, I don't know how you do it every day with the amount of material that you share. So thank you.
All right. Thank you, Joe. Appreciate you once again, my friend, and have a great holiday season.
Thank you so much. You too, Darren. And thanks again for having me on.
Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast.
We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck, because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.